pushes his nose against the little cold metal door and it swings inward. He sticks his head in, lifting the door just far enough to sniff deep and look around. People, food, place. Hidden away is food, not out where he can see it, but where he can still smell it. Strongest of all, the smell of the bad thing. So strong that it leaves him uninterested in food. The smell repels and frightens him, but also attracts him, and curiosity draws him forward. He squeezes through the opening, the little metal door sliding along his back, along his tail, then falling shut with a faint squeak. Inside, listening, humming, ticking, a soft clink. Machine sounds, otherwise silence. Not much light, just little glowing spots up on some of the machines. He's not afraid, not. He creeps from one dark space to another, squinting into the shadows, listening, sniffing, but he does not find the thing that will kill you until he comes to the bottom of the stairs. He looks up and knows that the thing is in one of the spaces up there somewhere. He starts up the stairs, pauses, continues, pauses, looks down to the floor below, looks up, continues, pauses, and he wonders the same thing he always wonders at some point while chasing a cat. What is he doing here? If there's not food, if there's not a female in heat, if there's not anyone here to pet and scratch and play with him, why is he here? He doesn't really know why. Maybe it's just the nature of a dog to wonder what is around the next corner over the next hill. Dogs are special. Dogs are curious. Life is strange and interesting, and he has the feeling that each new place or each new day might show him something so different and special that just by seeing and smelling it, he will understand the world better and be happier. He has the feeling that a wonderful thing is waiting to be found, a wonderful thing he can't imagine, but something even better than food or females in heat, better than petting, scratching, playing, running along a beach with wind in his fur, chasing a cat, or even better than catching a cat if such a thing was possible. Even here, in this scary place, with the smell of the thing that will kill you so strong he wants to sneeze, he still feels that a wonderfulness might be just around the next corner. And don't forget the woman. The boy. They're nice. They like him. So maybe he can find a way to keep the bad thing from bothering them anymore. He continues to the top of the stairs into a narrow space. He pads along, sniffing at doors. Soft light behind one of them. And very heavy, bitter, the thing that will kill you smell. Not afraid. Not afraid. He's a dog. Stalker and hunter. Good and brave. Good dog. Good. The door is open a crack. He puts his nose into the gap. He could push it open wide or go into the space beyond it, but he hesitates. Nothing wonderful in there. Maybe somewhere else in this people place. Maybe around every other corner, but not in there. Maybe he can just leave now, go back to the alley, see if the fat man left out more food for him. That would be a cat thing to do, sneaking away, running. He's not a cat. He is a dog. But do cats ever get their noses scratched, cut deep, bleeding, sore for days? Interesting thought. He's never seen a cat with a scratched nose, has never gotten close enough to scratch one. But he is a dog, not a cat. So he pushes against the door. It eases open wider. He goes into the space beyond. Young man, bad thing, lying on black cloths above the floor, not moving at all, making no sound. Eyes closed. Dead? Dead, bad thing on the black cloths? He pads closer, sniffing. No. Not dead. Sleeping. The thing that will kill you eats and it pees, and now it sleeps. So it is like people in many ways, like dogs, too, even if it isn't either people or dog. What now? He stares at the sleeping bad thing, thinking how he might jump up there with it, bark in its face, wake it up, scare it, so then maybe it won't come around the woman and boy anymore. Maybe even bite it. Just a little bite. Be a bad dog for once. Just to help the woman and boy. Bite its chin or its nose. Doesn't look so dangerous sleeping. Doesn't look so strong or quick. He can't remember why it was scary before. He looks around the black room and then up, and the light glistens in a lot of eyes floating up there in bottles. People eyes without people. Animal eyes without animals. Interesting, but not good. Not good at all. Again, he wonders what he is doing here. He realizes this place is like a drain pipe where you get stuck, like a hole in the ground where big spiders live that don't like you sticking your snout in at them. and he realizes that the young man bad thing on the bed is sort of like those laughing boys, smelling of sand and sun and sea salt, who will pet you and scratch behind your ears and then try to set your fur on fire. Stupid dog. Stupid for coming here. Good, but stupid. The bad thing mumbles in its sleep. He backs away from the bed, turns, tucks his tail down, and pads out of the room. He goes down the stairs, getting out of there. Not afraid. Not afraid. Just careful. Not afraid. But his heart pounding hard and fast. Weekdays, Tanya Delaney was the private nurse on the graveyard shift from midnight until 8 o'clock in the morning. Some nights, she would rather have worked in a graveyard. Jennifer Drachman was spookier than anything Tanya could conceive of encountering in a cemetery. Tanya sat in an armchair near the blind woman's bed, silently reading a Mary Higgins Clark novel. She liked to read and was a night person by nature, so the wee hour shift was perfect for her. Some nights, she could finish an entire novel and start another because Jennifer slept straight through. Other times, Jennifer was unable to sleep, raving incoherently and consumed by terror. On those occasions, Tanya knew the poor woman was irrational and that there was nothing to be afraid of, yet the patient's angst was so intense that it was communicated to the nurse. Tanya's own skin would prickle with goose flesh. The back of her neck would tingle. She would glance uneasily at the darkness beyond the window as if something waited in it, and would jump at every unexpected noise. At least the pre-dawn hours of that Wednesday were not filled with shouts and tortured cries and strings of words as meaningless as the manic babble of a religious passionary speaking in tongues. Instead, Jennifer slept, but not well, harried by bad dreams. From time to time, without waking, she moaned, grasped with her good hand at the bed rail, and tried without success to pull herself up. With bony white fingers hooked around the steel, atrophied muscles barely defined in her fleshless arms, face gaunt and pale, eyelids sewn shut and concave over empty sockets, she seemed not like a sick woman in bed, but like a corpse struggling to rise from a coffin. When she talked in her sleep, she didn't shout, but spoke almost in a whisper. With tremendous urgency, her voice seemed to arise from thin air and float through the room with the eeriness of a spirit speaking at a seance.
He'll kill us all. Kill. He'll kill us all.
Tanya shivered and tried to concentrate on the suspense novel, though she felt guilty about ignoring her patient. At the least, she should pry the bony hand off the railing, feel Jennifer's forehead to be sure she was not feverish, murmur soothingly to her, and attempt to guide her through the stormy dream into calmer shoals of sleep. She was a good nurse, and ordinarily she would rush to comfort a patient in the grip of a nightmare, but she stayed in the armchair with her Clark book because she didn't want to risk waking Jennifer. Once awakened, the woman might slip from the nightmare into one of those frightening fits of shouting, tearless weeping, wailing, and glossolalic shrieking that made Tanya's blood turn to ice. Came the ghostly voice out of sleep.
The world's on fire! Tides of blood, fire and blood. I'm the mother of hell. God help me. I'm the mother of hell.
Tanya wanted to turn the thermostat higher, but she knew the room was already a bit too warm. The chill she felt was within her, not without.
Such a cold mind, dead heart, beating but dead.
Tanya wondered what the poor woman had endured that left her in such a dismal state. What had she seen? What had she suffered? What memories haunted her? The greenhouse on Pacific Coast Highway included a large and typical California-style restaurant filled with too many ferns and pothos even for Harry's taste, and a sizable barroom where fern-weary patrons had long ago learned to keep the greenery under control by poisoning the potting soil with a dribble of whiskey every now and then. The restaurant side was closed at that hour. The popular bar was open until 2 o'clock. It had been remodeled in a black-silver-green Art Deco style that was nothing like the adjacent restaurant, a strained attempt to be chic, but they served sandwiches along with the booze. Midst stunted and yellowing plants, about 30 customers drank, talked, and listened to jazz played by a four-man combo. The musicians were performing quirky, semi-progressive arrangements of famous numbers from the big band era. Two couples, who didn't realize the music was better for listening, were gamely dancing to quasi-melodic tunes marked by constant tempo changes and looping extemporaneous passages that would have thwarted Fred Astaire or Baryshnikov. When Harry and Connie entered, the 30-ish manager host met them with a dubious look. He was wearing an Armani suit, a hand-painted silk tie, and beautiful shoes so soft-looking that they might have been made out of a calf fetus. His fingernails were manicured, his teeth perfectly capped, his hair permed. He subtly signaled one of the bartenders, no doubt to help give them the bum's rush back into the street. Aside from the dried blood at the corner of her mouth and the bruise only beginning to darken one whole side of her face, Connie was reasonably presentable, if slightly rumpled, but Harry was a spectacle. His clothes, baggy and misshapen from having been rain-soaked, were more wrinkled than an ancient mummy's shroud. Formerly crisp and white, his shirt was now mottled gray, smelling of smoke from the house fire he'd barely escaped. His shoes were scuffed, scraped, muddy. A moist, bloody abrasion as big as a quarter marred his forehead. He had heavy beard stubble because he hadn't shaved in 18 hours, and his hands were grimy from pawing through the pile of dirt on Ortegaard's lawn. He realized he must appear to be only a treacherous step up the ladder from the hobo outside the bar to whom Connie had just delivered a warning about forced detoxification, even now socially devolving before the scowling host's eyes. Only yesterday, Harry would have been mortified to appear in public in such a state of dishevelment. But now he didn't particularly care. He was too worried about survival to fret about good grooming and sartorial standards. Before they could be ejected from the greenhouse, they both flashed their special project's ID. "Police," Harry said. No master key, no password, no blue blood social register, no royal lineage opened doors as effectively as a badge. Opened them grudgingly, more often than not, but opened them nonetheless. It also helped that Connie was Connie.
"Not just police," she said, "but pissed off police having a bad day in no mood to be refused service by some prissy son of a bitch who thinks we might offend his effete clientele."
They were graciously shown to a corner table that just happened to be in the shadows and away from most of the other customers. A cocktail waitress arrived at once, said her name was Bambi, crinkled her nose, smiled, and took their orders. Harry asked for coffee and a hamburger medium well with cheddar. Connie wanted her burger rare, with blue cheese and plenty of raw onions.
"Coffee for me, too. And bring both of us double shots of cognac. Remy Martin."
To Harry, she said,
"Technically, we're not on duty anymore, and if you feel as crappy as I feel, you need more of a jolt to the system than you're going to get from coffee or a burger."
While the waitress filled their orders, Harry went to the men's room to wash his grubby hands. He felt as crappy as Connie suspected, and the restroom mirror confirmed that he looked even worse than he felt. He could hardly believe that the grainy-skinned, hollow-eyed, desperation-lined face before him was his face. He vigorously scrubbed his hands, but a little dirt stubbornly remained under his fingernails and in some knuckle creases. His hands resembled those of a car mechanic. He splashed cold water in his face, but that didn't make him look fresher or less distraught. The day had taken a toll from him that might forever leave its mark. The loss of his house and all his possessions, Ricky's gruesome death, and the bizarre chain of supernatural events had rattled his faith in reason and order. His current haunted expression might be with him for a long time, assuming he was going to live beyond a few more hours. Disoriented by the strangeness of his reflection, he almost expected the mirror to prove magical, as mirrors so often were in fairy tales, a doorway to another land, a window on the past or future, the prison in which an evil queen's soul was trapped, a magic talking mirror like the one from which Snow White's wicked stepmother learned that she was no longer the fairest of them all. He put one hand to the glass. Warm fingers met cold, but nothing supernatural happened. Still, considering the events of the past 12 hours, it was not madness to expect sorcery. He seemed to be trapped in a fairy tale of some kind, one of the darker variety, like the Red Shoes, in which the characters suffer terrible physical tortures and mental anguish, die horribly, and then are finally rewarded with happiness not in this world, but in heaven. It was an unsatisfying plot pattern if you were not entirely sure that heaven was, in fact, up there and waiting for you. The only indication that he hadn't become imprisoned in a children's fantasy was the absence of a talking animal. Talking animals populated fairy tales even more reliably than psychotic killers populated modern American films. Fairy tales, sorcery, monsters, psychosis, children. Suddenly, Harry felt he was teetering on the edge of an insight that would reveal an important fact about Tick-Tock. Sorcery, psychosis, children, monsters, fairy tales. Revelation eluded him. He strained for it. No good. He realized he was no longer lightly touching his fingertips to their reflection, but was pressing his hand against the mirror hard enough to crack the glass. When he took his hand away, a vague, moist imprint remained for a moment, then swiftly evaporated. Everything fades, including Harry Lyon. Maybe by dawn. He left the restroom and walked back to the table in the bar where Connie was waiting. Monsters, sorcery, psychosis, fairy tales, children. The band was playing a Duke Ellington medley with a modern jazz interpretation. The music was crap. Ellington simply didn't need improvement. On the table stood two steaming coffee cups and two brandy snifters with Remy, glowing like liquid gold. "The burgers will be a few minutes," Connie said, as he pulled out one of the black wooden chairs and sat down. Psychosis, children, sorcery. Nothing. He decided to stop thinking about Tick-Tock for a while, give the subconscious a chance to work without pressure. "I gotta know," he said, giving Connie the title of a Presley song.
"Know what?"
"Tell me why."
"Huh?"
"It's now or never." She caught on, smiled.
"I'm a fanatical Presley fan."
"So I gathered."
"Came in handy," she said.
"Probably kept Ortegaard from throwing another grenade at us, saved our lives."
"To the king of rock and roll,"
she said, raising her brandy snifter. The band stopped torturing the Ellington tunes and took a break, so maybe there was a God in heaven after all, and blessed order in the universe. Harry and Connie clinked glasses, sipped. He said, "Why Elvis?" She sighed.
"Early Elvis, he was something. He was all about freedom, about being what you want to be, about not being pushed around just because you're different. Don't step on my blue suede shoes. Songs from his first 10 years were already golden oldies when I was just 7 or 8, but they spoke to me, you know?"
7 or 8? Heavy stuff for a little kid. I mean, a lot of those songs were about loneliness, heartbreak.
"Sure. He was that dream figure, a sensitive rebel, polite but not willing to take any shit, romantic and cynical at the same time. I was raised in orphanages, foster homes, so I knew what loneliness was all about, and my heart had some cracks of its own."
The waitress brought their burgers and the busboy refreshed their coffee. Harry was beginning to feel like a human being again. A dirty, rumpled, aching, weary, frightened human being, but a human being nonetheless.
"Okay," he said. "I can understand being crazy for the early Elvis, memorizing the early songs. But later? Do the clam?"
Shaking ketchup onto her burger, Connie said,
"In its way, the end's as interesting as the beginning. American tragedy."
"Tragedy? Winding up a fat Vegas singer in sequined jumpsuits?"
"Sure. The handsome and courageous king, so full of promise, transcendent. Then, because of a tragic flaw, he takes a tumble, a long fall, dead at 42.
"Died on a toilet."
"I didn't say this was Shakespearean tragedy. There's an element of the absurd in it. That's what makes it an American tragedy. No country in the world has our sense of the absurd."
"I don't think you'll see either the Democrats or Republicans using that line as a campaign slogan anytime soon," said Harry. The burger was delicious. Around a mouthful of it, he said, "So, what was Elvis's tragic flaw?"
"He refused to grow up. Or maybe he wasn't able."
"Isn't an artist supposed to hold on to the child within him?"
She took a bite of her sandwich, shook her head. Not the same as perpetually being that child. See, the young Elvis Presley wanted freedom, had a passion for it, just like I've always had. And the way he got total freedom to do anything he wanted was through his music. But when he got it, when he could have been free forever, well, what happened?
Tell me, said Harry. She had clearly thought a lot about it.
Elvis lost direction. I think maybe he fell in love with fame more than freedom. Genuine freedom. Freedom with responsibility, not from it. That's a worthy adult dream. But fame is just a cheap thrill. You'd have to be immature to really enjoy fame, don't you think?
I wouldn't want it. Not that I'm likely to get it.
Worthless, fleeting, a trinket only a child would mistake for diamonds. Elvis, he looked like a grown-up, talked like one.
Sure as hell sang like a grown-up when he was at his best, said Harry.
Yeah, but emotionally he was a case of arrested development, and the grown-up was just a costume he wore, a masquerade, which is why he always had a big entourage like his own private boys' club and ate mostly fried banana sandwiches with peanut butter, kids' food, and rented whole amusement parks when he wanted to have fun with his friends. It's why he wasn't able to stop people like Colonel Parker from taking advantage of him.
Grown-ups, children, arrested development, psychosis, fame, sorcery, fairy tales, arrested development, monsters, masquerade. Harry sat up straighter, his mind racing. Connie was still talking, but her voice seemed to be coming from a distance.
So the last part of Elvis's life shows you how many traps there are.
Psychotic child, fascinated by monsters, with a sorcerer's power, arrested development, looks like a grown-up, but masquerading. Connie continued.
How easy it is to lose your freedom and never find your way back to it.
Harry put down a sandwich.
My God, I think maybe I know who TikTok is.
Who?
Wait, let me think about this. Shrill laughter erupted from a table of noisy drunks near the bandstand. Two men in their 50s with a look of wealth about them, two blondes in their 20s. They were trying to live their own fairy tales, the aging men dreaming of perfect sex and the envy of other men, the women dreaming of riches and happily unaware that their fantasies would one day seem dreary, dull, and tacky even to them. Harry rubbed his eyes with the heels of his hands, struggling to order his thoughts.
Haven't you noticed there's something childish about him? TikTok? That ox?
That's his golem. I'm talking about the real TikTok, the one who makes the golems. This seems like a game to him. He's playing with me the way a nasty little boy will pull the wings off a fly and watch it struggle to get airborne, or torture a beetle with matches. The deadline at dawn, the taunting attacks, childish, as if he's some playground bully having fun. He remembered more of what TikTok had said as he had risen from the bed in the condo just before he'd started the fire.
You people are so much fun to play with. Big hero. You think you can shoot anyone you like, push anyone around if you want, push anyone around if you want.
Harry? He blinked, shivered. Some sociopaths are made by having been abused as children. But others are just born that way, bent.
Something screwed up in the genes, she agreed.
Suppose TikTok was born bad.
He was never an angel, said Connie.
And suppose this incredible power of his doesn't come from some weird lab experiment. Maybe it's also a result of screwed up genes. If he was born with this power, then it separated him from other people the way fame separated Presley, and he never learned to grow up, didn't need or want to grow up. In his heart, he's still a child, playing a child's game. I mean, a little child's game.
Harry recalled the bearish vagrant standing in his bedroom, red-faced with rage, shouting over and over again.
Do you hear me, hero? Do you hear me? Do you hear me? Do you hear me? Do you hear me? Do you hear me?
That behavior had been terrifying because of the hobo's size and power, but in retrospect it distinctly had the quality of a little boy's tantrum. Connie leaned across the table and waved one hand in front of his face.
Don't go catatonic on me, Harry. I'm still waiting for the punchline. Who is Tick-Tock? You think maybe he actually is a child? Are we looking for some grade school boy, for God's sake?
No, he's older. Still young, but older.
How can you be sure?
Because I've met him.
Push anyone around if you want.
He told Connie about the young man who had slipped under the crime scene tape and crossed the sidewalk to the shattered window of the restaurant where Ødegaard had shot up the lunchtime crowd. Tennis shoes, jeans, a Tecate beer t-shirt. He was staring inside, fascinated by the blood, the bodies. There was something eerie about him. He had this faraway look, and licking his lips as if there was something erotic about all that blood. Those bodies. He ignored me when I told him to get back behind the barrier, probably didn't even hear me, like he was in a trance, licking his lips. Harry picked up his brandy snifter and finished the last of his cognac in one swallow.
Did you get his name? Connie asked.
No, I screwed up. I handled it badly. In memory, he saw himself grabbing the kid, shoving him across the sidewalk, maybe hitting him and maybe not. Had he jammed a knee into his crotch? Jerking and wrenching him, bending him double, forcing him under the crime scene tape.
I was sick about it later, he said. Disgusted with myself. Couldn't believe I'd roughed him up that way. I guess I was still uptight about what had happened in the attic, almost being blown away by Ødegaard, and when I saw that kid getting off on the blood, I reacted like
me, Connie said, picking up her burger again.
Yeah, like you. Although he had lost his appetite, Harry took a bite of his sandwich because he had to keep his energy up for what might lie ahead.
But I still don't see how you can be so damn sure this kid is Tick-Tock, Connie said.
I know he is.
Just because he was a little weird.
It's more than that.
A hunch?
A lot better than a hunch. I call it cop instinct. She stared at him for a beat, then nodded.
All right. You remember what he looked like?
Vividly, I think. Maybe as young as 19, no older than 21 or so.
Height?
An inch shorter than me.
Weight?
Maybe 150 pounds. Thin. No, that's not right. Not thin. Not scrawny. It's lean, but muscular.
Complexion?
Fair. He's been indoors a lot. Thick hair, dark brown or black. Good-looking kid. A little like that actor Tom Cruise, but more hawkish. He had unusual eyes. Gray, like silver with a little tarnish on it. Connie said,
What I'm thinking is we go over to Nancy Kwan's house. She lives right here in Laguna Beach.
Nancy was a sketch artist who worked for special projects and had a gift for hearing and correctly interpreting the nuances in a witness's description of her suspect. Her pencil sketches often proved to be astonishingly good portraits of the perps when they were at last cornered and hauled into custody.
You describe this kid to her, she draws him, and we take the sketch to the Laguna police, see if they know the little creep.
Harry said, What if they don't?
Then we start knocking on doors, showing the sketch.
Doors? Where?
Houses and apartments within a block of where you ran into him. It's possible he lives in that immediate area. Even if he doesn't live there, maybe he hangs out there, has friends in the neighborhood.
This kid has no friends.
Or relatives. Someone might recognize him.
People aren't going to be real happy we go knocking on their doors in the middle of the night. Connie grimaced.
You want to wait for dawn?
Guess not. The band was returning for their final set. Connie chugged the last of her coffee, pushed her chair back, got up, took some folding money from one coat pocket and threw a couple of bills on the table.
Let me pay half, Harry said.
My treat, said Connie.
No, I should pay half. She gave him an are you nuts look.
I like to keep accounts in balance with everyone, you know that, he explained.
Take a walk on the wild side, Harry. Let the accounts go out of balance. Tell you what, if dawn comes and we wake up in hell, you can buy breakfast.
She headed for the door. When he saw her coming, the host in the Armani suit and hand-painted silk tie scurried into the safety of the kitchen. Following Connie, Harry glanced at his wristwatch. It was 22 minutes past 1 o'clock in the morning. Dawn was perhaps 5 hours away. padding through the night town, people in their dark places, all drowsy around him. He yawns and thinks about lying under some bushes and sleeping. There's another world when he sleeps, a nice world where he has a family that lives in a warm place and welcomes him there, feeds him every day, plays with him any time he wants to play, calls him Prince, takes him with them in a car and lets him put his head out the window in the wind with his ears flapping. Feels good. Smells coming at him dizzy fast. Yes, 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 and never kicks him. It's a good world in sleep, even though he can't catch the cats there either. Then he remembers the young man bad thing, the black place, the people and animal eyes without bodies, and he isn't sleepy anymore. He's got to do something about the bad thing, but he doesn't know what. He senses it is going to hurt the woman, the boy, hurt them bad. It has much anger, hate. It would set their fur on fire if they had fur. He doesn't know why, or when, or how, or where. But he must do something. Save them. Be a good dog. Good. So? Do something. Okay. So? Until he can think what to do about the bad thing, he might as well look for some more food. Maybe the smiling fat man left some more good scraps for him behind the people food place. Maybe the fat man is still there in the open door, looking this way and that way along the alley, hoping to see Fella again, thinking he would like to take Fella home, give him a warm place, feed him every day, play with him any time he wants to play, take Fella for rides in cars with his head sticking out in the wind. Hurrying now, trying to smell the fat man. Is he out in the open? Waiting? Sniffing, sniffing. He passes a rust-smelling, grease-smelling, oil-smelling car parked in a big empty space, and then he smells the woman, the boy, even through the closed windows. He stops, looks up. Boy sleeping, can't be seen. Woman leaning against the door, head against window. Awake, but she does not see him. Maybe the fat man will like the woman, the boy, will have room for all of them in his nice warm people place, and they can play together, all of them, eat when they want, go for rides in cars with their heads sticking out windows, smells coming at them dizzy fast. Yes, 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 yes. Why not? In the sleep world there's a family. Why not in this world, too? He's excited. This is good. This is really good. He feels the wonderful thing around the corner, wonderful thing coming that he always knew was out there somewhere. Good, yes, good. Yes, 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 yes. The people food place with the fat man waiting is not far from the car, so maybe he should bark to make the woman see him, then lead her and the boy to the fat man. Yes, 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 yes. But wait, wait. Could take too long getting them to follow him. People are so slow to understand sometimes. The fat man might go away. Then they get there, the fat man is gone. They're standing in the alley, and they don't know why. They think he's just a stupid dog, stupid, silly dog, humiliated like when the cat is up in the tree looking down at him. No, 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 no. Fat man can't go away, can't. Fat man goes away, they won't be together in a nice warm place or in a car with the wind. What to do, what to do? Excited. Bark? Don't bark? Stay. Go. Yes, no. Bark. Don't bark? Pee. Gotta pee. Lift the leg. Ah, yes. Strong-smelling pee. Steaming on the pavement. Steaming. Interesting. Fat man. Don't forget the fat man waiting in the alley. Go to the fat man first, before he goes inside and is gone forever. Get him and bring him back here. Yes, 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 yes. Because the woman and the boy are not going anywhere. Good dog. Smart dog. He trots away from the car, then runs to the corner. Around. A little farther. Another corner. The alley behind the people food place. Panting. Excited. He runs up to the door where the fat man gave out scraps. It's closed. The fat man's gone. No more scraps on the ground. He's surprised. He was so sure. All of them together like in the sleep world. He scratches at the door. Scratches, scratches. The fat man doesn't come. The door stays closed. He barks. Waits. Barks. Nothing. Well, so? Now what? He's still excited, but not as much as before. Not so excited that he has to pee, but too excited to be still. He paces in front of the door, back and forth across the alley, whining in frustration and confusion, beginning to be a little sad. Voices echo to him from the far end of the alley, and he knows one of them belongs to the stinky man who smells like everything bad at once, including like the touch of the thing that will kill you. He can smell the stinky man really well, even from a distance. He doesn't know who the other voices belong to, can't smell those people so much because the stinky man's odor covers them. Maybe one is the fat man, looking for his fella. Could be. Wagging his tail, he hurries to the end of the alley, but when he gets there, he finds no fat man, so he stops wagging. Only a man and a woman he's never seen before, standing near a car in front of the people food place with the stinky man, all of them talking.
"You really cops?" says the stinky man. "What did you do to the car?" says the woman. "Nothing. I didn't do anything to the car. If there's any crap in this car, you're a dead man." "No, listen, for God's sake. Forced detox, you scumbag. How could I get in the car with it locked?" "So you tried, huh? I just wanted to nose around, see you were really cops." "I'll show you are we really cops or not, you hairball." "Hey, let go of me." "Jesus, you stink." "Let go of me. Let go of me."
"Come on, let him go." "All right, easy now," says the man who isn't so stinky. Sniffing, sniffing, he smells something on the new man that he smells on the stinky man, too, and it surprises him. The touch of the thing that will kill you. This man has been around the bad thing not long ago.
"You smell like a walking toxic waste dump," says the woman.
She also has on her the smell of the thing that will kill you. All three of them, stinky man, and woman. Interesting. He moves closer, sniffing.
"Listen, please, I've got to talk to a cop," says the stinky man. "So talk," says the woman. "My name's Sammy Shamro. I got a crime to report." "Let me guess, somebody stole your new Mercedes." "I need help." "So do we, pal."
All three of them not only have the touch of the bad thing on them, but they smell of fear, the same fear he has smelled on the woman and the boy who called him Woofer. They're afraid of the bad thing, all of them.
"Someone's going to kill me," says the stinky man. "Yeah, it's going to be me if you don't get out of my face. Easy, easy now," the stinky man says. "And he's not human either. I call him the Rat Man."
Maybe these people should meet the woman and the boy in the car. All of them afraid separately. Together, maybe not afraid. Together, all of them, they might live in a warm place, play all the time, feed him every day. All of them go places in a car, except the stinky man would have to run behind unless he stopped being stinky enough to make you sneeze.
"I call him the Rat Man because he's made out of rats. He falls apart and he's just a bunch of rats running every which way."
But how? How to get them together with the woman and the boy? How to make them understand? People being so slow sometimes. When the dog came sniffing around their feet, Harry didn't know if it was with the bum, Sammy, or if it was just a stray on its own. Depending on how obstreperous the vagrant became, if they had to use force with him, the dog might take sides. It didn't look dangerous, but you never could tell. As for Sammy, he appeared to be more of a threat than the dog. He was wasted from life on the street and from whatever had put him there, worse than skinny, spindly, Salvation Army giveaway clothes hanging so loosely on him that you expected to hear bones rattling together when he moved, but that didn't mean he was weak. He was twitchy with excess energy. His eyes were so wide open, the lids seemed to have been stretched back and pinned out of the way. His face was tight with tension lines, and his lips repeatedly skinned back from bad teeth in a feral snarl that might have been meant to be an ingratiatingly smile, but was alarming instead.
"The Rat Man, see, is what I call him, not what he calls himself. Never heard him call himself anything. Don't know where the hell he comes from, where he's hiding his ship. He's just all of a sudden there. Just there, the sadistic bastard, one scary son of a bitch."
In spite of how weak he appeared to be, Sammy might be like a robotic mechanism receiving too much power, circuits overloading, on the trembling verge of exploding, disintegrating into a shrapnel of gears and springs and burst pneumatic tubes that would kill everyone within a block. He might have a knife, knives, even a gun. Harry had seen shaky little guys like this who looked as if a strong gust of wind would blow them all the way to China. Then it turned out they were stoned on PCP, which could transform kittens into tigers, and three strong men were required to disarm and subdue them.
"See, maybe I don't care if he kills me. Maybe that would be a blessing. Just get totally drunk and let him kill me. So wasted I'd hardly notice when he does me,"
Sammy says, crowding them, moving to the left when they moved in that direction, to the right when they tried that way, insisting on a confrontation. But then tonight, I was deep in the bag, sucking down my second double liter, I realized who the Rat Man has to be. I mean, what he has to be. One of the aliens.
Aliens, Connie said disgustedly. Aliens. Always aliens with you dim bulbs. Get out of here, you greasy hairball, or I swear to God I'm gonna...
No, no. Listen, we've always known they were coming, haven't we? Always known, and now they're here, and they've come to get me first. And if I don't warn the world, then everyone's gonna die.
As he took hold of Sammy's arm and tried to maneuver him out of their way, Harry was almost as leery of Connie as he was of the bum. If Sammy was an overwound clockwork mechanism ready to explode, then Connie was a nuclear plant heading for a meltdown. She was frustrated that the vagrant was delaying them from getting to Nancy Kwan, the police artist, acutely aware that dawn was rushing toward them from the east. Harry was frustrated, too, but with him, unlike with Connie, there was no danger that he might knee Sammy in the crotch and pitch him through one of the nearby restaurant windows.
I don't want to be responsible for aliens killing the whole world. I've already got too much on my conscience, too much. Can't stand the idea of being responsible. I've let so many people down already.
If Connie thumped the guy, they would never get to Nancy Kwan or have a chance to locate Tick-Tock. They would be tied up here for an hour or longer, arranging for Sammy's arrest, trying not to choke to death on his body odor, and struggling to deny police brutality. A few bar patrons were watching them, faces to the glass. Too many precious minutes to be lost. Sammy grabbed at Connie's jacket sleeve.
Listen to me, woman! You listen to me!
Connie jerked loose of him, cocked her fist.
No!
Harry said. Connie barely checked herself, almost through the punch. Sammy was spraying spittle as he ranted.
It gave me 36 hours to live, the Rat Man, but now it must be 24 or less, not sure.
Harry tried to hold Connie back with one hand as she reached for Sammy again, while simultaneously pushing Sammy away with the other hand. Then the dog jumped up on him, grinning, panting, its tail wagging. Harry twisted away, shook his leg, and the dog dropped back onto the sidewalk on all fours. Sammy was babbling frantically now, clutching with both hands at Harry's sleeve and tugging for attention as if he didn't have it already.
His eyes like snake eyes, green and terrible, terrible, and he says, I got 36 hours to live. Tick-tock, tick-tock.
Fear and amazement quivered through Harry when he heard that word, and the breeze off the ocean seemed suddenly colder than it had been. Startled, Connie stopped trying to get at Sammy.
Now, wait a minute. What did you say?
Aliens! Aliens!
Sammy shouted angrily.
You're not listening to me, damn it!
Not the aliens part, Connie said.
The dog jumped on her. Patting its head and pushing it away, she said,
Harry, did he say what I think he said?
I'm a citizen, too!
Sammy shrieked. His need to give testimony had escalated into a frenzied determination.
I got a right to be listened to sometimes!
Tick-tock! Harry said.
That's right,
Sammy confirmed. He was pulling on Harry's sleeve almost hard enough to tear it off.
Tick-tock, tick-tock, time is running out. You'll be dead by dawn tomorrow, Sammy. And then he just dissolves into a pack of rats right before my eyes.
Or a whirlwind of trash, Harry thought, or a pillar of fire.
All right, wait, let's talk, Connie said. Calm down, Sammy, and let's discuss this. I'm sorry for what I said. I really am. Just get calm.
Sammy must have thought she was insincere and merely trying to humor him into letting his guard down because he didn't respond to the new respect and consideration she accorded him. He stamped his feet in frustration. His clothes flapped on his bony body, and he looked like a scarecrow shaken by a Halloween wind.
Aliens, you stupid woman! Aliens, aliens, aliens!
Glancing at the greenhouse, Harry saw that half a dozen people were at the barroom windows now, peering out at them. He realized what a singular spectacle they were, all three of them bedraggled, tugging and pulling at each other, shouting about aliens. He was probably in the last hours of his life, pursued by something paranormal and incredibly vicious, and his desperate fight for survival had been transformed, at least for a moment, into a piece of slapstick street theater. Welcome to the 90s. America on the brink of the millennium. Jesus. Muffled music filtered to the street. The four-man combo was playing some West Coast swing now. Kansas City, but with weird riffs. The host in the Armani suit was one of those at the bar windows. He was probably silently berating himself for being fooled by what he now surely believed were phony badges and would go any second to call the real police.
A passing car slowed down, driver and passenger gawking.
"Stupid, stupid, stupid woman!"
Sammy shouted at Connie. The dog took hold of the right leg of Harry's trousers, nearly jerked him off his feet. He staggered, kept his balance, and managed to pull free of Sammy, though not the dog. It squirmed backward, striving with canine tenacity to drag Harry along with it. Harry resisted, then almost lost his balance again when the mutt abruptly let go of him. Connie was still trying to soothe Sammy, and the bum was still telling her that she was stupid, but at least neither was trying to hit the other. The dog ran south along the sidewalk for a few steps, skidded to a halt in the downfall of light from a street lamp, looked back, and barked at them. The breeze ruffled its fur, fluffed its tail. It dashed a little farther south, halted in shadows this time, and barked again. Seeing that Harry was distracted by the dog, Sammy became even more outraged at his inability to get serious consideration. His voice became mocking, sarcastic.
"Oh, sure, that's it. Pay more attention to a damn dog than me. What am I, anyway? Just some piece of street garbage? Less than a dog? No reason to listen to trash like me. Go on, Timmy. Go on, see what Lassie wants. Maybe Dad's trapped under an overturned tractor down on the fucking South 40.
Harry couldn't help laughing. He would never have expected a remark like that out of someone like Sammy, and he wondered who the man had been before he'd wound up as he was now. The dog squealed plaintively, cutting Harry's laugh short. Tucking its bushy tail between its legs, pricking up its ears, raising its head quizzically, it turned in a circle and sniffed at the night air.
"Something's wrong," Connie said, worriedly looking around at the street.
Harry felt it too. A change in the air, an odd pressure. Something. Cop instinct. Cop and dog instinct. The mutt caught a scent that made it yelp in fear. It spun around on the sidewalk, biting at the air, then rushed back toward Harry. For an instant, he thought it was going to barrel into him and knock him on his ass, but then it angled toward the front of the greenhouse, plunged into a planting bed full of shrubbery, and lay on its flat belly, hiding among azaleas, only its eyes and snout visible. Taking his cue from the dog, Sammy turned and sprinted toward the nearby alleyway. Connie said,
"Hey, no, wait!"
and started after him. "Connie?" Harry said warningly, not sure what he was warning her about, but sensing that it was not a good idea for them to separate just then. She turned to him.
"What?"
Beyond her, Sammy disappeared around the corner. That was when everything stopped.